Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, I will welcome everybody to the LSE, both online and in person. We have an audience. I would like to, this is a hybrid event, so of the book, and I'm going to read all my notes out so that I don't make a single mistake. Mediate the Middle, Moving With and Beyond Dichotomies. My name is Ellen Halsper, and I'm a professor of social and digital inequalities here in at the LSE in the Media and Communications Department. And I am, of course, very pleased to welcome Professor Bart Kammerts and Professor Emerita Robin Mansell, who will be given comments after Bart presents the book. So Bart Kammerts probably doesn't need any introduction, but is the professor of politics and communication in the Department of Media and Communications, and at the LSE, of course. He's also the former chair of the Communication and Democracy section of the European Communication and Research Association, ACREA. And of course, he is here today to present the book that I'm hoping you are all here for. Robin Mansell is Professor Emerita in the Department of Media and Communications at the LSE, and her research focuses on media and communications regulation and policy, digital governance, privacy, and surveillance. Her most recent books are Information Ecosystems and Troubled Democracy and The Need to Rename Tech. So do check out her books as well. For those social media users, ex-users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Events. It's right here for those who want to copy it. I would ask you in the audience here to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to there being no technical. I'll explain the event format a little bit. As usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to our speakers. For our online audience, please use the questions, the Q&A feature, and include your name and affiliation so that we know who's asking the questions. For those of you here in the theater, I will let you know when we will open the floor to questions. Please also raise your hand and wait for the stewards with the roving microphones. They will be walking around. To get to you, please let us know also your name and affiliation as you ask a question. I will try to ensure that there's a range of questions from both online and offline audiences. For our in-person attendees, books will be on sale after the event, just outside the lecture theatre, and Professor Kammerts will be signing them, so special edition. Please make sure that you get one. There will also be a reception, so do stick around if you're here in person. And that is it for me. I will talk no more and leave the floor to Professor Bart.
Thank you, Alan. Welcome, everybody, for coming along. I stand on the shoulders of giants. Giants who guided and shaped my thinking, and I very much wanted to start by thanking and also honoring them. The giants past and present, those here on stage, but also my colleagues and friends who are here today in the room and beyond. Thanks for all you gave me and taught me. My new book, which we are celebrating today, is also a result of their mentorship, their insights, their reflections, and their stances. In the book, I start each chapter with a bit of media and communication history, and I want to start this public lecture with a reflection on the history of the very room that we are in here. The LSE's old theater has a long and fascinating legacy. One such legacy are the debates between John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich von Hayek. On invitation of LSE economics professor Lionel Robbins, the Austrian economist Friedrich von Hayek gave four lectures on this very stage in 1931. In the lectures, which were slightly more packed than today, I would say, Von Hayek delivered a blistering attack on Keynes and state-led Keynesianism. And at the heart of their debate lay a deep-seated polarity in terms of social policy and the role of the state. Whereas Keynes advocated full employment and a maximalist intervention of the state into the economy, von Hayek, on the contrary, heralded the minimal state, focused on the protection of property and individual freedoms and a laissez-faire approach, which he argued would lead to a new equilibrium. It is in this regard interestingly paradoxical that Keynes, who was a very rich man through playing on the stock exchange, became the intellectual stalwart of socio-economic policies enacted by social democracies across Europe and the US. Whereas von Hayek, who during his entire life never worked in the private sector, eventually became the intellectual guru of neoliberalism, celebrating a retreat of the state and deregulation. It's also interesting to reflect on the tone of their debate and how it was waged. It was often quite petty, vindictive, sarcastic, and very virulent. When the Cambridge-based political economist Arthur Cecil Pigou came to speak also in this very room in 1935, he lamented, "Are we in our secret hearts wholly satisfied with the manner or manners in which our controversies are carried on?" He critiqued the methods of the duello as performed by von Hayek and Keynes. This is actually the cover of a hip-hop single by Econ Stories, and the video is a parody on this conflictual relationship. Let's have a quick 30-minute listen.
John Maynard Keynes.
F.A. Hayek.
Yeah, we're opposed.
We oppose each other philosophically
in the same studio.
We've been going back and forth for a century. I want to steer markets.
I want them set free.
There's a boom and bust cycle and good reason to fear it.
Play more interest rates.
No, it's the animal spirit.
John Maynard Keynes wrote the book on modern macro. The man you need when the economy's off track. Whoa. Depression, recession, now your question's in session. Have a seat and I'll school you in one simple lesson. Boom.
That's enough. This music and video production brings us neatly to the field of media and communication. My friend and colleague Mike Derzer wrote that my book provides a map to the stars. Being a humble person at heart, I would not go that far. But I would say that it does provide a comprehensive overview and a wide variety of approaches and theories relating to media and communication, as well as their intersections with political and social theory. I did not necessarily aim to be exhaustive or all-encompassing. Broadly speaking, I focus and engage with the critical school of thought in media and communication and its conversations with Marxism, anarchism, radical liberalism, and republicanism, at Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I came at an age as an academic and intellectual at a time when we also observed and participated ourselves in virulent and at times even dismissive debates within the critical school and thought of our field, employing the method of the duello. I could refer in this regard to the debates between political economy and cultural studies, between Nicholas Garnham and Lawrence Grossberg, but also between those who were doubling down on the universal enlightenment values of modernism and those embracing postmodernism, post-structuralism, and post-colonial epistemologies. Along the same lines, we could also refer here to the discursive fights between proponents of Habermas's rational public sphere theory in one corner and Mouffe's agonistic conflictual spaces in the other. The way these debates were dueled out was in itself also quite conflictual, which made that the positions taken were often stark and the drawn swords did not allow for much ambiguity or middle ground positions. Reconciliation between political economy and cultural studies is futile, wrote Lawrence Grossberg. Communication action is always strategic action, wrote Lata Thomasson. While these debates and tensions very much shaped my intellectual journey, I've also always been felt being pulled in different and at times even opposing directions when it comes to these debates and what each position values and foregrounds. I was personally educated in a strong modernist, Marxist Enlightenment tradition on the one hand and a Habermasian public sphere theories on the other. Rest in power. Gradually, however, once I was left to fly on my own, I increasingly felt drawn to the neo and post-Marxist arguments of cultural studies, the position that the political is inherently conflictual, and the post-Marxist arguments of cultural studies, the position that the political is inherently conflictual, and the post-structuralist critiques which underpins this. But it's also important to understand that, for me at least, this did not necessarily mean a complete disavowal of the ideas, values, premises, and critiques of respectively political economy and public sphere theory. What I'm trying to say here is that sometimes two things can be true at the same time. In the contemporary political moment, we can all see how acutely important and prescient the normative ideals are as put forward by Habermas. His insistence on the importance of veracity, rational discourse in the political sphere, his emphasis on a degree of civility in public debate, and for grounding a political deliberation which should be geared towards solutions in the public and collective interest. We can all see how important that is. But at the same time, we cannot and should not ignore, deny, or reject the public sphere critiques from political theory, from feminism, from post-colonial critiques. Only considering rational speech as legitimate speech does exclude. Power cannot be bracketed away, and many truths are shaped by ideologies, by interests, and by hegemonic common sense. Accepting that the superstructure can have some independence from the economic base, or critiquing the arrogance of the false consciousness thesis, does not necessarily exclude a position which still recognizes the importance of the material, of ownership structures, and that many people do indeed vote against their own interests. We can align ourselves with the Enlightenment values of liberté, égalité, et fraternité, and advocate that human rights are quintessentially human rights, universal rights, while at the same time acknowledging that cultures differ, that these rights might be articulated differently in different contexts, and that Enlightenment ideals also served and still serve to justify racist ideologies, colonialism, slavery, and imperialist wars. It suffices in this regard to refer to how feminism, sexual freedoms, or freedom of speech are currently being weaponized by neo-fascists against people of different faiths and non-Western communities. So it would be fair to say that I found myself often ending up at a middle ground position, seeing both sides of an argument, both sides of the coin, and at times even trying and miserably failing to reconcile the irreconcilable, to subsequently try again and fail better, to quote Samuel Beckett. One possible critique of this position might indeed be that it precisely defies taking sides. It represents sitting on the fence. It's also so reminiscent of the typical academic response of, on the one hand, and on the other hand. My response to this valid critique would be to say that I do take a strong position, namely a deeply critical disposition. But as we all know, the critical school is a broad school, and I personally find that many critiques formulated from within the critical school can be seen to work together, complementary, coming at an issue or phenomena from different angles, and with a different premise and focal point, and also often using a varied set of methodological tools, with each raising valid points and fielding probing critiques. All this was a very, very roundabout way to get you to understand why I'm interested in dichotomies, but especially in the lure of the middle, in the dialectic and dynamic interplay between the different sides of a dichotomy, in the tensions and overlaps between them, the ambivalences, the liminal. In the introduction of the book, I explain that a dichotomy typically refers to a division into two contradictory and contrasting parts, classifications, and categorizations. Dichotomies are relational, which means that it's either this or that, thereby excluding both at the same time. In his book, Core Sociological Dichotomies, edited by the British sociologist Chris Jenks, he writes that dichotomous thinking creates a space from within which others' differences can emerge. They help us clarify debates and tensions within each side of the dichotomy, as well as between the two sides of the dichotomy. These debates are also often foundational to a scientific field or discipline. At the same time, however, empirical reality is often much more messier than neat and mutually exclusive categories. And as such, we also need to consider existing simultaneously. As Jenks put it, the balance between the extremes often helps us achieve a clearer answer in the middle ground. It's important to stress at this point that the dichotomies I chose to focus on are not definitive nor exhaustive of our field. They are the ones I think that are most relevant to explore the critical field of media and communication. But having said that, I do not think that is that useful or interesting for me to summarize each chapter here. If I would do that, there would be no reason for you to read it. So what I thought I would do is to focus specifically on online platforms and some excursions into AI to address each of the dichotomies discussed in the book and the questions the use of and ownership of platforms and AI raises in the context of these dichotomies. First and foremost, and relating to the distinction between media and communication, the emergence of platforms and more recently AI has disrupted and complicated what we understand media and communication to be, as in the media on the one hand and telecommunication or communication tools, networks on the other. Platforms are both at the same time. And AI does not even fit that neatly into categories of media and communication. We communicate with AI and AI communicates with us. But it also conveys information, content to us, not always accurate or reliable, though. Does this make AI a medium, or does it merely train on media content? It certainly does have characteristics of a medium, but maybe more a psychic one, an oracle making things up on the basis of what is already out there as knowledge. Social media and platforms have for many decades successfully lobbied not to be seen nor regulated as media. Instead, they consistently and strategically position themselves as networked communication tools reminiscent of the communication network. Why? Primarily because a telephone operator is not liable for the content that circulates through its network. So if someone plans a crime via the telephone operator is not responsible for this. They are legally allowed to deny intermediary liability, as these quotes from US and EU law attests. This telecom logic was subsequently applied to social media platforms, which enabled them to largely renounce, up until now at least, any responsibility for the content circulating on their platform. At the same time, however, social media platforms are also media. It says so on the tin. Platforms and the algorithms that underpin them make editorial decisions all the time about what content to highlight, what to trend, what to shadow ban, and what to remove. But because of the communication and telecommunication logic just mentioned, we are unable to apply the same ethical standards and democratic responsibilities onto social media platforms that we expect from legacy media. Platforms and AI algorithms show the continued relevance of the tension between media and communication. As we will see, this does play itself out in various ways. One area in which this tension becomes acutely visible and even lived is in the context of privacy protections and what is commonly known as opacity, the right to be left alone, not only to be left alone by states, but also by corporations. The business model of platforms and AI amounts to what Shoshana Zuboff coined as surveillance capitalism. Surveillance capitalism, which basically means that our online behavior is intimately monitored, recorded, and commodified by big tech. We are the product that platforms sell to other companies, as well as to political actors that are willing and able to pay to get access to the algorithm, with a view of targeting us with their advertising, their propaganda, and disinformation. Regulatory interventions to rein in the power of and surveillance practices of these online private monopolies are merely tinkering at the edges without necessarily fundamentally questioning their business model, which, as mentioned, is based on extraction and commodifying our digital footprint. The EU's GDPR, or General Data Protection Regulation, is the world's most robust online privacy regulation. But in practice, it amounts to users having to explicitly agree to their own surveillance and exploitation, whilst saying no often results in not being able to access the platform or use a particular service. All this speaks to a lack of political will to have a proper democratic debate and discussion on the nature and the extent of public interest in the context of what was then called the information. The extent of public interest in the context of the hybrid media system we live in. The last time we had a kind of really international debate on what public interest means in the context of what was then called the information society was 20 years ago with the ITU's World Summit on the Information Society. And even that process was largely boycotted and derailed by US and by the US and Silicon Valley. They strategically reduced issues relating to the internet and the information society to technical matters rather than having democratic, social, or societal importance. It is also interesting to position this tension between public and private in the context of ownership, as political economists would do. In Europe, we have a long and proud tradition of public service broadcasting, to be distinguished from state-controlled broadcasters. Despite multiple pressures and neoliberal overtures, this tradition is still going strong in Europe and beyond. Given this history and tradition, it is surprising and a missed opportunity that calls from critical voices in academia to imagine and build a public service internet imbued with public and democratic values and interests rather than commercial ones never quite cut through. On the contrary, even, in many European countries, public service broadcasters have for many years been dissuaded by political elites, as well as by the lobby efforts of private media companies and the tech sector to develop internet-based services, nor have they been given the resources to do so. It is only quite recently, in the wake of US fascist lunacy, that we are starting to hear European policymakers discussing the prospect of EU-based infrastructures and services independent from the US and Silicon Valley. In my view, this is an opportunity to plan and ascertain how we can realize a public service internet and develop public service search engines, cloud services, social media platforms, map technology, and indeed public service AI. We can also approach platforms and AI from the perspective of the production of content, and by extension also of the production of meanings encoded into the content. Content is not merely produced by media professionals alone anymore. We are the producers and generate content too, and a lot of it. Any problem or issue we have, any recipe we want to try, any tutorial we need, it is all out there at the tip of our fingers. We are not merely producing content, we are also producing data on an hourly basis. Our data exhaust gets subsequently harvested, processed, and commodified by the very platforms we use. With AI, things become even more complicated. Tools are said to be capable of producing images, video, advice, summaries, code, and apparently, so I've been told, even academic essays. At the same time, however, these agents are trained on content that is produced by others. What AI produces are ultimately upcycled reproductions based on original creative labor of humans. The production of content and meaning goes hand in hand with the consumption of content and the reception of meaning, or as Stuart Hall would put it, decoding the encoded media content. Hall also introduced the idea of the active audience of media, moving away from the rather passive positioning of audiences in media domination theories. Today we might speak of the hyperactive audience. Consumption of content through social media is highly fragmented and goes way beyond mere spectatorship. It is denoted as engagement, measured through clicks, likes, shares, and comments, which in themselves could be seen as another form of production. As mentioned before, algorithmic power decides who and what we get to see. But this means that no one's feed is exactly the same. We are experiencing a mass individualization in terms of what information gets fed to us. But at the same time, algorithmic power also creates echo chambers and filter bubbles, and in doing so, feeding polarization and a coarsening of public discourse. As mentioned, while the content that is circulating through platforms is highly diverse, its reach is often quite limited, though, hence my reference here to the long tail. Unless something goes viral because it is deemed attractive by the algorithm. But what is attractive to the algorithm? What is attractive to the platforms? It's not necessarily attractive for our societies, for our democracies, for our mental well-being. On the contrary, even. Platform algorithms tend to highlight content that is negative, which incites division, whips up fears, peddle lies, and conspiracy theories. This harmful content circulating through platforms and influencing the influencers has a powerful and detrimental symbolic and discursive impact. Platform algorithms privilege certain frames over above others and actively amplify hate speech, racism, sexism, queerphobia, while shadow buying minority and left-wing positions of solidarity and peace. These are some of the examples we found during a research I'm doing with my colleague Nick Anstead on propagandistic visual misinformation that was circulating on social media platforms during the latest 2024 election cycle in Belgium, France, UK and the US. Visual misinformation, we found, is circulating much more in right-wing echo chambers than they are in left-wing ones. Some of these use AI, others photo doctoring, and again others tap into meme culture. It is apparent here how satire and a form of bigoted humor is being weaponized by the fascist right. Use of humor and satire can also be seen in this context as an attempt to immunize racism against critique. But if you critique this, you do not have a sense of humor, do you? You're a brittle snowflake. You're an out-of-touch wokey. A survey done a few years ago found that 2 in 3 people often encounter hate speech and disinformation on social media platforms, and 9 out of 10 of those surveyed was of the opinion that these platforms should do something about it. It was done in several countries, 8,000 respondents. Up until now, the responsibility for this is not placed on the platforms and AI companies inflicting damage on society and on democracy, on cultural production, but mainly on us, on individuals. On individuals like us, whose responsibility it is to be media, internet, and AI literate, to identify misinformation, to identify AI slop, to avoid being scammed, to navigate polarization, and to protect our privacy. Besides symbolic and discursive power, platforms and AI also have a less visible and obvious material side. We can think here of our phones, our iPads, our laptops as central and important devices to access the internet, the platforms, and the AI tools. Embedded in these devices are a whole range of rare metals needed to provide us with the processing power to produce, to consume, to field prompts, to watch content, etc. These resources are increasingly called conflict minerals, and our dire need for tantalum or coltan, tin, tungsten, and gold has and is fueling a gruesome war in East Congo, which has been going on since 2004, and you can go even further than that with the genocide in Rwanda, but rarely or never gets reported on our legacy media. When considering the materiality of platforms and AI, we also need to consider the underlying infrastructures, that which is off the radar, below notice, or off stage, as John Durham Peters puts it. We can think in this regard of the undersea cables, satellite technology, mobile infrastructures, cable networks, server and data farms, etc. This also brings the energy consumption needed to sustain these infrastructures into the picture. The sheer energy needed to build and operate these platforms and AI infrastructures is huge, as is the necessary processing power as well as storage capacity. All this has enormous hidden environmental costs. The Dutch environmental data scientist Alex de Vries Gao calculated that the carbon footprint of AI systems alone could be between 32, 33, let's say, and 80 million tons of CO emissions in 2025, while water footprint could be 313, or between 313 and 765 billion liters. So if you kind of like put this into perspective, this is the same range as the carbon footprint of New York City, and similarly like the water footprint of or like the entire global consumption of bottled water. If you want to have another example of this in terms of cryptocurrencies, in 2025, a single Bitcoin transaction was deemed to consume as much water as fits into a backyard swimming pool, and the same amount of power a typical US household uses for 24 days. Moving to the dichotomy of mainstream media and alternative media. When we map platforms and AI onto the relational distinction between mainstream and alternative media as we knew it a few decades ago, it feels a bit like a shape sorter we had as kids, whereby the pieces don't quite fit. In the context of platforms and AI, the category of mainstream and alternative have become difficult to demarcate and makes less sense. Already 20 years ago, British alternative media scholar Chris Atten asked the question, does it even make sense to talk about alternative media in cyberspace? Today, what we used to call mainstream media is increasingly labeled as legacy media. And while we certainly can observe and identify alternative counter-hegemonic usage of platforms and increasingly also of AI, at the same time, these platforms and AI are essentially mainstream capitalist spaces and tools which are extractive and come with many limitations in terms and conditions. These terms and conditions can easily be invoked to ban, remove, silence critical voices, turning social media from the open liberal spaces it pretends to be into illiberal and repressive spaces of closure. The example of WikiLeaks is a case in point in this regard. If you contest and transgress too much according to the powers that be, platforms will ostracize you and remove the content you produced. The case of WikiLeaks also shows us that platforms are not just about social media. They can also be website hosts. They can also be financial platforms collecting donations. More recently, pro-Palestinian sentiments and voices have also been actively suppressed on so-called liberal social media platforms. Research by Human Rights Watch found that the censorship of content relating to Palestine on Instagram and Facebook is systemic and global. At the same time, these generated resistant tactics from users, developing alternative codes and symbols to circumvent the oppressive practices of the platforms. Sympathizers of the Palestinian cause and people started using a symbol dating back to the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel banned displaying the Palestinian flag in Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians back then started using watermelons to circumvent the ban, which is appropriate today to circumvent content moderation and shadow banning. What is clear, however, is that our conception of alternative media as developed in the 1960s and entrenched throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, namely of a horizontal, basic democratic media by communities for communities and independent from state and market, ni Dieu ni maître, of which Libération in its early days was a good example. This idea of alternative media, unfortunately, has died on the internet. Arguably, a lot of alternative media was not entirely independent from the state and market either, but setting up a pirate radio station is still an option. A clandestine press operation is still possible. While alternative content can and does circulate on and through these platforms, the idea of a truly independent alternative media is difficult to realize online. While platforms present themselves as neutral actors and deny being media, as I already said, they do exert editorial control, or what we could call access power. As here Van Dijk and colleagues put it, some platforms have carved out gatekeeping positions in the ecosystem that gives them enormous leverage. In this regard, it's important to acknowledge and understand that not all alternative content is equal on platforms. Indeed, radical right and neo-fascist discourses are amplified and monetized by many platforms, whereas left-wing discourses are increasingly and actively deplatformed. What all this calls for is the need to be much more precise and clearer about what alternative and radical actually means and refers to, and ask ourselves the question, alternative to what? And radical to achieve which goals and aims? For whom? The media life that we live today through platforms, our feeds, and AI is one of managing and navigating what we could call information abundance. As Pablo Bukowski points out, this is an ambivalent experience for most of us. While we derive various gratifications from living abundant media lives, enjoyment, leisure, connections, relationships, there are also a range of issues and complexities in dealing with information abundance. I already referred to the circulation of mis- and disinformation, which speaks to Steve Bannon's strategy of flooding the zone. Indeed, our contemporary experiences of media life is characterized by the coexistence of poverty of fact and the wealth of fictions, Bukowski explains here. Furthermore, information abundance in the context of war, genocide, natural disasters, or famine holds the danger of desensitization of human suffering. There are only so many gruesome and horrific images of wars and destruction one can endure on a daily, monthly, and yearly basis. While not always a logical outcome, this can easily lead to what is sometimes called compassion fatigue, characterized by diminishing emotional responses, rising indifference, and cynicism. Information abundance inevitably dovetails with time and attention scarcity, as we are simply incapable of processing and interpreting this vast amount of information that is directed at us. All the updates from our friends, also and acquaintances, the news of what is happening in the world, the podcasts we consume, the doom scrolling we engage in. The quantitative here clashes with the qualitative. And while distraction technologies vie for our attention and also for our eyeballs, we are left to deal with information and communication abundance in our everyday lives, which takes a toll of a lot of mental energy and arguably scatters many people's attention spans. You can also observe how information abundance constitutes an opportunity as well in terms of especially for AI companies, and this presents us with an interesting conundrum. Traditionally, copyright was sacrosanct in the context of content production, distribution, and consumption. It created an alternative scarcity, enabling creators and cultural industries to commodify cultural production. Digitalization, technological innovations, as well as user resistance, have brought us to a point whereby any digital product today can be found, watched, read, listened to, shared, and copied globally for free. Something Rasmus Fleischer, one of the founders of Pirate Bay, termed copyright. The shadow library LibGen project, which many of you are probably familiar with, is a Russian-based website emanating from the alternative media Samizdat tradition, which provides free access to 113 million documents and 480 terabytes of copyright-protected content, measured in May 26, but this keeps expanding every month, mainly academic books, journal articles, fiction, magazines, and comics. Lawsuits brought to light, however, that Meta's AI model, Llama 3, as well as OpenAI's ChatGPT, were trained on this library. In a court filing, Meta claimed that using this illegal database constitutes fair use. In other words, Meta claims that language models here learn from copyright-protected content. They learn, and that's fair use. They produce transformative new work, and just like we humans do all the time. Therefore, Meta argues, using this material, we just use it for training purposes, which is legal and fair. Totally logical. The tension between control and freedom is also highly relevant and applicable in different ways when it comes to platforms and AI. While technically states control the internet and platforms, mainly through licenses and regulatory intervention, in reality and in line with neoliberal ideology, the logic of internet regulation is often one of self-regulation by the platforms themselves rather than top-down imposition of the state on platforms. As such, they have a high degree of control in terms of what happens on their platforms. One aspect of the dichotomy between control and freedom that is particularly salient in the context of platforms and algorithms that govern them is how they relate to freedom of speech and its limitations. Given that most of the platforms we use are based in the US, they align themselves with the First Amendment doctrine or a more maximalist interpretation of freedom of speech. As a result of this, and amplified by the weaponization of freedom of speech by neo-fascist forces, racist hate speech, violent sexism, and anti-LGBTQ discourses are rampant and widespread. what we are observing, in fact, is that what we could call an asymmetrical freedom of speech. Freedom of speech for bigots and fascists, while blatant censorship and shadow banning of those that contest them. The idea of freedom cannot, however, be reduced to freedom of speech. Freedom also means freedom to be trans, freedom to live in a society without being discriminated against for the color of your skin, your gender, or your sexuality. Freedom of speech thus needs to be balanced against other freedoms and rights, also online. If we accept, then, that content moderation to counter hate speech is a form of control, we should also argue that freedom requires some form of control to protect certain rights, to protect minorities from the tyranny of the white heteronormative majority. In this regard, and as I also outline in the book, Isaiah Berlin's distinction between positive and negative freedom is useful and potentially productive. Whereas negative freedom protects us from unwarranted state intervention, positive freedom precisely creates the public and democratic intervention, so the conditions to make freedom for all a possibility. As far as I'm concerned, it is not a matter anymore of whether platforms and AI need to be regulated, but rather how and to which extent. I will come back to that in a minute, but first I want to address the question as to why it is that we let these platforms get away with undermining our democracy, invading our privacy, etc. Oh, that's for later. The clue for this goes back to what I outlined earlier in the context of media and communication as a tension. So these kind of telephone companies that are not liable. And so, in other words, media companies can also kind of say, oh, we do not have anything to say to do with that. Besides this, the other factor that we should encounter or consider is the distinction between the virtual and the real. Since the advent of the internet, the techno-optimist vision of the virtual and cyberspace was consistently positioned as a space where other rules applied, a space where certain ideals that could not be realized in the real world would be possible to realize. A truly equal level playing field, a frictionless economy, horizontal online communities, mutual aid, online public sphere, virtual participatory democracy. So paradoxically, the distinction between the virtual and the real and pulling these apart also help platforms evade their social responsibilities as well as the legal limitations which apply in the real world. Just to kind of give an example of freedom of speech, we all have, certainly in Europe, anti-hate speech laws, we have equality acts which protects minorities, combat discrimination, but somehow these do not apply to platforms or AI. And this brings us to my friend Lenin's famous question, what is to be done? At an end of term reception last week, some smart students of ours, and they are all very smart, of course, told me that we are good as academics at formulating critiques, but less forthcoming when it comes to providing solutions and alternatives. We can relate this to the Gramscian distinction between critiquing what is and articulating what ought to be. Or let's say the difference between a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the will, or the hope that another world is possible, that other choices can and maybe also should be made. I retorted to them that as academics and public intellectuals, we constantly engage with normative and prognostic question of what ought to be. But the problem is that our ought to be's are more often than not discarded, deemed unrealistic, or simply considered to be batshit crazy by the economic and political powers that be, by the neoliberal hegemony, and by the extractive logic of capitalism. Like the shape sorters mentioned earlier, our solutions do not fit in the hegemonic spaces. But what for its worth, finally, here's my take. I already mentioned that I think we should go develop a third way that kind of is an alternative to both capitalist-controlled Silicon Valley and state-controlled Shenzhen. But when it comes to the US-based platforms, we could start by simply applying our privacy, anti-hate speech, and anti-discrimination laws to social media platforms. But where needed, we should also be bold and vote new laws, preferably at an EU level, to compel platforms and AI services to fulfill their social and democratic roles and to respect democratic laws and privacy protections. If they refuse to comply, we should be bold enough to cut their access to the European user and consumers. In this regard, we should not ban children from social media, but we should force platforms and AI to create a safe environment for children and adults alike. Wouldn't that be a nice idea? Recently, after it became clear that Elon Musk's AI tool Grok enabled the creation and distribution of AI-generated child pornography, Ofcom, as well as the EU, promptly started investigation. And once it became clear that many countries were actually willing to block Grok, Starmer, for example, warned that X could lose its right to self-regulate, Musk chickened out and removed so-called child sexual abuse material. What this example also shows is that besides self-regulation besides the fact that self-regulation does not work, it is also not because technology is able to do something that we should necessarily allow it to. In these times of war and genocide, we can see how we have arrived at a point where machines can be developed to kill independently, using AI without any human intervention. A frightening moment against which ethical engineers and the global campaign against killer robots have warned for years. Surely this warrants also a new intervention in terms of global arms controls. I will end by saying that it's not because US and Israel are flaunting international law in a flagrant way that we should give up on an international order and the idea of regulation to protect democratic values and freedoms. It is not because things look bleak and dark at the moment that we should give up on hope, and above all that we should think that resistance is futile. On the contrary, let's resist and celebrate this optimism of the will, while at the same time cherish the pessimism of the intellect and celebrate the critical mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much, Bart. Robin, I believe, is going to provide some comments and perhaps questions for us to think about before we start with the Q&A.
Good evening, everyone. Bart, it's quite an honor to be asked to comment on the book, and you covered the book very well in your lecture. Much of what he said is in it, and it is really brilliant. When I had the opportunity to read it before it was published, this is what I said. Bart succeeds masterfully in disrupting fruitless determinations in accounts of media history and impacts. I could stop there, because that is exactly what you do, and you've done that in the lecture tonight as well. But he does it in an extremely engaging way. He weaves theories, empirics, and policy together. It's quite unusual for academics to do that, you know. He does this in the name of activism and emancipation from the clutches of those who would oppress. He shows us why, and we've heard this, dichotomies or dualisms that populate research in the media and communications field are not just artifacts of intellectual thought. These dichotomies that he's talked about matter for how the mediated world is developing. They matter for communication processes and media content, for the way communication processes and media content harms individuals, how they can destabilize democracies, and crucially, for whether we can open up new potentials and spaces for resistance. When I was reading the book, initially I was reminded of a quote in a somewhat obscure book by Matthew Josephson, writing in the 1930s about capitalism in the United States from 1860s to 1900, he said, "The power of the mighty industrial overlords of the country had increased with giant strides. Of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth. The tyranny of a plutocracy." He went on to say, "Someday we will relieve these overlords of their labors. We will say, this is our cart and we will take it." He was writing about robber barons. He was writing about business tactics leading to the accumulation of vast wealth and the complicity or inaction of governments and the immiseration of citizens. The robber barons of today, of course, are the tech companies and many media conglomerates. Their tyranny is exercised through infrastructure control, through algorithmic distortions and biases, through data extractions, through hosting and promotion of false or very harmful content, through exploitation of their workers. I could go on, and Bart has told us a lot about that in his talk. Media and communication scholarship is replete with research on these developments. An awful lot of it is what I would call mainstream. It describes. It does not challenge this tyranny. It does not really challenge the big tech companies or oppressive states or offer alternatives. But then when it comes to critical research, it may critique structural determinations of power, or it may call our attention to epistemic hegemony achieved through symbolic and ideological mediations. What Bart achieves in his book, which is really important, is to show us why these traditions need to be in conversation with each other, because, as he insists, both in the book and tonight, they exist in dialectical tension. And this is not the same as opposition or some gray blurring. Bart shows how dialectical tension create possibilities to assert agency, to change the mediated spaces in the interests of the excluded, the disadvantaged, and those who are discriminated against by corporate tyrants and by oppressive states. As Josephson said, this book shows us how we should think about 21st century digital platforms and media, and how we might take them back. A core lesson in Bart's book is this: coercive mediated power always operates in dialectical tension with emancipatory spaces of resistance. He drives home the point that dichotomous thinking, either or thinking, is essentialist. Thinking this way leaves no room for heterogeneity, for contradiction, ambiguity, and ambivalence. In the empirical world, this is reality, though. Theory that does not acknowledge this messiness might seem coherent, but like the neocon economists who simplify away everything that really matters in the world, the theory cannot contribute to emancipatory change. Bart has introduced you to this explanation of common dichotomies or intersections between concepts in the field of media and communications, and I'm not going to repeat them, fortunately, because partly I don't have time, but partly they're well covered. One reason we can learn so much from Bart's analysis of these dichotomies, though, is because of the extensive tour of theories of power and how to think about dialectical tensions. For the students in this audience who say, ooh, not more theory, I say this too, but let me tell you, this is a very, very engaging account of theory. We get a tour through coercive power, Weber, empowerment, Negri, hegemonic power, Gramsci and Lukes, symbolic power, Bourdieu, discursive power, Foucault, and resource power, Marxian economic base and capitalism. My goodness me, that is a lot, but it works. It helps to elucidate the way the media communications environment works. It is a lot, but it works to show us different ways of understanding media communications as a complex mediated process, not one that fits neatly into a singular theoretical framing. And in this department, how often do we tell you we are interdisciplinary, we draw on different theories? What is especially important is this: understanding dialectical relations is never the same thing as trying to achieve a balance between contending epistemologies or practices, such as public or private media. I'm not sure Bart will agree with me about this, because I don't like the word balance. Think about how often you have been told that we need to balance capitalist aspirations for profit with human rights and democracy. Think of all the policy documents you have read. We need to balance one against the other. Calls for balance, which are everywhere in policy documents, are symptoms of dichotomous thinking. Balancing leaves the tyrants in charge so that they can continue to dominate. Big tech is constantly seeking new ways to dominate and exploit. The recent court ruling in the Meta versus U.S. versus Meta case found Meta guilty of intentionally capturing young platform users' attention despite knowing the harms. And the lesson from Bart's analysis is that big tech will persist in devising new ways to oppress, notwithstanding the court judgment. But it is also a lesson from his book that this is a moment of new opportunity for resistance and action. Dominance and resistance work in dialectical tension. Bart succeeds in unveiling multiple paradoxes, like that one. I especially appreciate this, because in my own work, I've always been fascinated by paradoxes in the media and communications field. As Bart said, a paradox happens when two things that seem to be in opposition are actually true at the same time. Example, a again echoing Bart's talk, regulation to counter hate speech is also a form of state oppression or censorship. We see this if we understand freedom and control in tension with each other, not in opposition. But, and this is crucial, this kind of both-and thinking is not the same as a denial of hegemony and its consequences. Bart's dialectics of power analysis reveals what the tyrants prefer to keep hidden from us. It helps in creatively finding ways to repair the harms that the tyrants create. Disrupting dichotomies means understanding contradiction. It means revealing what resistance can achieve and acting to change things. To finish, the critic John Berger said, and I quote, "The relation between what we see and what we know is never settled." Bart's book is a provocation to all of us to go beyond either-or thinking and the conceptual dualisms that populate our fields. That way, we do have a hope of changing the world for the better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. And also for those lovely words of a book that I also read before it was published, and I have many of the same observations. I do hope everybody reads it. It's inspiring as well as informative and interesting. So we're now going to go into the Q&A. We'll open the floor to questions from the audience, both here and online. I will collect a few questions. Please collect your thoughts on your questions. And then if you are online, you can type your questions into the Q&A box and we will try to answer as many as possible. As I said at the beginning, please do include your name and affiliation. For those here, it's the same thing. Please raise your hand, tell us who you are, and wait for the roving mic to come so that also people who are attending virtually can hear you and everybody in the room can hear you. Is there any question right now? So that we can, I'll start with a question in the room. If there is questions in the room, here in the front, please. Any other questions? And I will collect a few. If not, we'll just take.
Hello, my name is Peter. I'm simply a member of the public. I failed my first degree in the University of Life, but never mind. One of my ideas is that the biggest influence on the media is the media itself. And I've been very surprised in the past, thinking about mainstream media more than modern stuff, I've been very surprised by how ignorant senior journalists have been of that possibility. And these are thinking people, presumably. So I don't know what to make of that, the utter ignorance of the elites of the significance of what they're doing. So
okay.
That's it.
So, could you, unless there's another question here in the room, Bart, do you want to have a go at, from the perspective of your book and your writing, to think about an explanation for this phenomenon or for questions that that raises?
Is that a question about media effects? Kind of like that the media themselves is ignorant about the effects they have on society, more or less. Yeah, I mean, the question of media effects in our field is a box of Pandora. it's a very contentious and difficult issue, what exactly the effects is of media and how we kind of isolate the effect of media on people's opinion formation from other factors that influence our political opinion formation. And so journalists also, yeah, they are also part of a machine. And sometimes you don't quite see the water that you're swimming in anymore, which I think is maybe one of the reasons why that ignorance that you observe might be there.
Thank you so much for that. That was really wonderful and very, very interesting. I'm wondering that if we consider categories such as mainstream and alternative to be unstable categories in and of themselves, I wondered if you might propose or share perhaps a more productive framework to think about hierarchies within producers of media content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, it's kind of a question of what alternative to what, and I mean, there is so much that is circulating at the moment, which kind of is legacy media, but we also have online things like Novara Media or kind of like other kind of platforms or podcasts or that do sometimes fulfill, let's say, resistant or counter-hegemonic kind of roles in terms of providing alternative sources, being alternative sources of information. But that can also be misleading. It can also feed into misinformation. So that's, I also think that's why we kind of increasingly have people using legacy media rather than kind of mainstream media, because these categories have become kind of so empty to some extent, whereby online a lot of kind of the mainstream media content also circulates online. So yeah, alternative kind of concepts to kind of make sense of that, that complexity, I guess, of different types of contents that circulate on older forms of media versus online. Yeah, I don't think we haven't that vocabulary yet in terms of kind of really pinning down alternative content that circulates on mainstream platforms, or indeed mainstream content that circulates in alternative spaces as well. Or I mean, in the US, for example, at the moment, the kind of mainstream media comedy late shows can be seen as a kind of alternative form of content. So yeah, it kind of all dissolved into each other to some extent.
Robin, did you?
Just a thought about alternative word. In my experience over the last 2 years, working with people around the world, not all of whom were academics, what I noticed particularly was their very strong commitments to the political meaning of alternative. So although they might say different things, they might have been alt-right, they might have been alt-left, their commitment was to this word because it somehow differentiated them, and it also helped them to fundraise, to support something that was not either directly state-funded or privately funded. So I think we have to differentiate between the way academics think about these words and the way people out there in the world who are struggling think about these words.
Let's take two questions, I think. Is there any further questions here and end of?
Jean-Christophe Plantin, colleague of BART. Can you tell us which one of the dichotomies give you the hardest time reconcile? And have you left any dichotomies because, not in the book, out of the book, because you couldn't reconcile them?
And we'll take a second question, yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. So my name is Arseny Vladonov, and we also consider theory and practice as different parts, as also kind of dichotomies in like scientific works and stuff. But can we consider, for example, theory as practice, or theory as a practice of resistance, for example, if we talk about media theory? Thank you.
Which dichotomy was the most difficult one to write? The one that I came up the last was media and communication. I hadn't kind of like thought, and that's maybe also a false dichotomy, but it is a kind of defining dichotomy in our field, I guess. The media on the one hand and communication as a process. But the most difficult one, I think, to kind of like really grapple my head around was freedom and control. Because of the way they kind of speak to each other, and because of the complexities of needing forms of control to guarantee freedom, but also that can also transgress into overbearing. So it's kind of like arguing we need more regulation in terms of content for hate speech, for example. You could easily construe that in terms of like, oh yeah, you want to censor, you want to kind of take away our right to speak, and so where do you find that balance? Not balance, because we don't like balance. but yeah, how to kind of like guarantee freedom of speech or freedom more in general, freedom of being, and how forms of control can kind of impede that but also make it possible. And that is a kind of difficult argument to develop and grapple with, I would say. So that was kind of, I think, the most difficult one to write. And yeah, sure, of course, I mean, I don't see theory and practice necessarily as that separate from each other, at least for a lot of us, kind of like theory is also something to kind of make sense of the world. And if you kind of want to reflect on theory as practice, I mean, there are also traditions of grounded theory where we go into the field. I mean, we are doing a kind of project at the moment with an arts and activist collective in India, Kenya, and Edinburgh, which, yeah, we are, a lot of the kind of insights we are gaining now, theoretical insights, come from practice and from our observations in the field, and not the other way around. So you can kind of like, yeah, you can get, you can, and theory also for me has kind of two facets. It is kind of trying to explain, critique, reflect, understand the way things are, but it, like I implied in my talk, there is also theory that can be normative and kind of explains us maybe how things ought to be. And that's kind of more a normative perspective. So these are also different ways of employing theory, both to critique and understand, but also to articulate what should maybe change and in what direction.
Are there any questions online? Yes. Could you please pass the microphone? We'll take some questions from the online audience and then we'll come back.
This is from an anonymous user. Is it possible to build sustainability through hegemonic domination? A question from Jack Sanskartier. I wonder if there's been consideration of using design approaches as a way to reimagine the architecture of the platform. What might it mean to have a Bauhaus moment but for online life?
Could you repeat that last one? Divine intervention?
Design approaches as a way to reimagine the architecture of the platform.
Like a Bauhaus.
Yeah. Design, okay, I'll give you another one as well.
It's about design intervention, not design intervention. Design intervention.
Sustainability is obviously something I touched upon in terms of the kind of energy consumption as well as the kind of metals that we use in our kind of digital tools and in the consumption of the networks. That is going to be a very difficult issue to tackle, I think, in terms of kind of like reaching sustainable goals, whilst at the same time we want this kind of like infrastructures to be performative, and we all use the services of maps and mobile technologies, and that doesn't not square very well with the kind of sustainability agenda of kind of like where we would need to make certain radical interventions. Certainly, if we are thinking in this context of a kind of existential crisis of climate change, and where certain radical measures need to be taken, but the question is a bit of a leading one. can this be achieved through hegemonic domination? Now, if we look at the kind of like discourses coming out of the tech industry, it's kind of all the problems with tech can be solved with our tech. Problems of AI can be solved, more AI. So that kind of answers that question, that I don't see that kind of necessarily being solved within that kind of framework. I was a bit confused. Designing interventions to achieve what?
Design approaches as a way to reimagine the architecture of the platform.
Some things at some point I did say in my talk, other choices can always be made, and other kind of design interventions, but The problem that we are faced with, I think, and it's also what kind of Robin was referring to, is that it's going to be very difficult to, through design, to kind of solve some of the issues that we are faced with, because this is, again, kind of more tinkering at the edges rather than addressing fundamental kind of issues that are that we deal with social media and AI platforms.
Thank you. I'll take the question in the room, if it's still, and then another one here. I think we have three, yeah. So here and the two in the middle. You can just raise your hand again so that the people with the roving mics can see.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jude. I'm also a student of BART in politics and communication. For me, I guess one of the biggest things that came up was, so you spoke about alternative media and how we have these echo chambers, algorithmic patterns, data patterns, and all of these issues that kind of, algorithmic issues that prevent the media from functioning the way that it should. And then we also discussed how mainstream media is also an issue in itself due to biases and more deep-rooted issues. So I guess, Bart, could you come up with, in an ideal world, do you have a hypothetical solution or a proposal that's different from alternative media and mainstream media, like maybe like an alternative media, and what would that look like for you?
Well, I'll take two more questions. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Camilla. I'm a member of the public. So thank you so much for that. A lot was kind of coming through me just because I run a business through social media, and I'm very aware of the rage baiting and the power of the algorithm in creating polarizing effects, even if you don't necessarily want to do that, but people using that as a way to grow their business, and obviously hate speech. And I guess what was coming up for me was how much of these issues are already prevalent systemically in society, and now people have this platform to express. How much is being influenced? So, for example, in Australia, people, I think they've banned social media use under the age of 16. So that's sort of helping people in that sort of vulnerable age. And I guess for me, is that enough? Just obviously, it's a great step in the right direction. It's, you know, helping people not have that hate speech. But how much of that is actually helping on the ground? Because if media communication is simply an expression of what is already existing, how, that's a bigger question, I guess. I guess what else could be done at a deeper level in society through the use of media and communications in a positive way? And what do you think about the age limit with social media and, I guess, certain types of access to media as well?
And there was second question, and then we'll give you a chance to answer those, and then we'll come to the other ones.
Hi, Dr. Hilary Bruffa from King's College London. I have a question about the concept at the beginning. Your point is about dichotomies, being able to hold two opposing ideas in your mind at the same time. What John Keats used to call it, negative capability, not trying to seek a resolution. And so it generates additional uncertainty and being comfortable with ambiguity. But then what are the implications, therefore, for media policymakers or other policymakers who are forced to take decisions and yet we're advocating being more comfortable with uncertainty? So what would be then the instrumental utility of this framework for decision makers? Thank you.
In terms of that ambiguity.
Yeah. Robin, did you have a comment?
It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, alternatives. Alternatives of the alternative. I guess during my talk, I kind of did point out that there is a third way that until now has remained relatively unexplored, and It's kind of something that has been on my mind for the last couple of months. It's like why we have this kind of strong legacy of public service broadcasting, and why isn't that logic also being translated to an online context? We do have BBC iPlayer, for example, but I'm more talking about the kind of tools we all rely on platforms and tools that are based in the US. I think there's maybe now a political opportunity to kind of pierce open and try to explore the possibility of whether we cannot kind of develop these infrastructures and platforms along a different logic. And sure, public service broadcasting is also not ideal and also has its flaws, but I think its ethos and its legacy is more interesting and more productive, I think, to also reflect on how this can be translated to have kind of all these services that we now use from Silicon Valley, but then without privacy, while still respecting our privacy and not targeting kind of advertising at us. That will open up a discussion about funding, obviously. But again, always different choices can be made. At some point, telephone networks were private and we made the democratic decisions to nationalize them. Not that I'm advocating for nationalization here, but similarly, there are other choices that could be made. And developing public service AI or public service social media or public service search engine that does give us kind of that whose results are not influenced by who pays the most. Why not? So that might be kind of an alternative to kind of look for. And of course, some of my colleagues have been working on these issues, and the Media Reform Coalition, for example, just to give a shout out. Hello, Lee. So yeah, it's not as if these ideas are not there, and that's also kind of my point of the ideas are there. It's just a matter of kind of the political will to realize them and to kind of push for these solutions. The power of the algorithm and also the detrimental impact of social media, and whether banning for under 16 years old is a good idea. I think I side here with my colleague Sonia, who is sitting incidentally next to you. in the sense that I think banning social media for children, for under 16 years old, is basically absolving platforms of their responsibility. It's basically saying, you can keep on doing what you're doing. We're just going to ban it for young children, for under 16 years old. Whereas the conversation should be different. The conversation should be, how can we make these platforms responsible for making a safe space for children, rather than banning them from using it? Because then you also create a forbidden fruit. You create something that is kind of like shiny out there and that they can't get access to, and also you deprive them from learning, I would say, and from learning about the world and also becoming adult at 16 years old, and all of a sudden so we should be kind of learning them to use responsibly on the one hand, but that's kind of again an individualization of responsibility, but at the same time also kind of force these platforms to create safe environments, and I would say not just safe environments for children, but also for us as adults. Then finally, the kind of ambiguities that are created by these dichotomies and how policymakers have to kind of navigate these and deal with these. That is why policymakers are there, I would say. There are always tensions, there are always different priorities, there are always kind of like competing interests, and policymakers are and democracy, I guess, in general is there to kind of, I wouldn't say balance, but compromise between those different tensions and different values and different kind of like interests that are out there, ideally privileging citizen interests over commercial and capitalist interests, as far as I'm concerned.
Robin, did you want to
just a comment about why we find it so difficult to imagine doing something differently, making different choices? And I think one of the big reasons is because there are so many myths out there that are propagated about what is feasible and what is not feasible. So, for example, when the Europeans talk about being more sovereign, sovereignty, not national or regional sovereignty, over the whole stack, from the infrastructure to the services on top to social media, the first response that comes from critics is, oh, it's so expensive, can't possibly do it. Yeah, we see that the French managed to turn off some of their social media and use nationally developed services, and the whole world has not fallen apart. And we also see that the costs of allocating resources to the military are in the billions and trillions, but the costs somehow of building indigenous infrastructures and social media services that respond to different values, something to do with public service, are seen as outlandish and not possible. And so therefore we need to think clearly about demolishing myths, taking them apart and saying, what is practical? What can be done? And why is it? And who is resisting making those alternative choices? And then I think we begin to see that there are possibilities. And when you move beyond the European world and go to countries which have historically had far fewer resources in order to develop their services, you see amazing things being done with very small resources. And so therefore, we shouldn't just think that everything is too hard and too difficult and too costly. The real choices, as Barta said, and we need to bring them to light, talk about them, and policymakers need to be more aware of them. Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll take a final round of questions because we're at the end of the event, but and here and here in the front. And I think that will be it. Yes, please go ahead.
I get so nervous asking questions of these things. I'm Craig Gent. I'm a colleague of Bart's as well. Bart, you've got me thinking about the dichotomies in my own life, and I'm having a bit of an existential crisis. I'm going to give you some pessimism of the intellect, and I hope you can give me some optimism of the will, if it's not too tall an order. I was struggling to formulate a question, and so I was sort of looking down at my hands, and in doing so, was reminded, because of the two tattoos on my forearms, and because you mentioned both of these things by names, of a central dichotomy in my life. One is a commitment to like an anarchist or an autonomous politics, and one is the time when I accidentally became a company director for Navarra Media. And I suppose lately I've been thinking a lot about like this question of infrastructure and digital environments, and you put up PeerTube, and so I've been thinking about like the Fediverse, which for people who don't know is this kind of alternative conception of how we might organize the internet and kind of platform economy. I would wager that most people haven't heard of it, but kind of alternatives to YouTube and so on. And I was thinking, like, what is it that's like stopping the Fediverse from becoming, you know, the new mainstream, let's say, to be slightly provocative, and from becoming a kind of like a counter power of the internet? Because my experience from working at Navarra Media tells me that although you can do very good things through generating progressive content, you have fundamental limitations. We were at 1 million subscribers and YouTube just cancelled our account one day. Okay, and so even though we said originally we were independent, alternative media, and then we said we were independent media, but of course we were not independent. We were wholly dependent on YouTube and that kind of ecology. And so I find myself in this bind where I wish that we could all kind of willfully like hop over to the Fediverse and kind of, you know, in a kind of more like anarchist-y or autonomous-y kind of way, like seize the kind of digital means of production. Yeah, I can't imagine how we would do so without making a viral YouTube channel, you know, professing the virtues of doing so in the first place. And so I wonder if you can help resolve this dichotomy for me.
Thank you. I'm looking at time, and we have to. I'm going to take this question in front, and I hope that the colleagues who have questions will ask it outside at the reception afterwards. Please go ahead, and you can wrap up there.
Sure.
Yeah.
My name is Ed, and I'm a member of the public. I dream of a future where balanced, complex, and gray zone thinking becomes the most thrilling movement of an era. But I don't remember when such attitude was perceived attractive or thrilling enough in mainstream. That was, I think, always reserved for the partisan and simple, sharp viewpoints. Is complexity and ambivalence always doomed to be a cold or cool stance and never be exciting?
Thank you very much.
Could you repeat the last bit of your always?
Doomed to be a cold or cool stance and never be exciting.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so if you can make your closing.
Craig, yes. I think, one of the kind of answers to your question is two words called network effects. as to why it's so difficult to kind of build an alternative and make people switch, although in my past, I'm old enough to kind of remember everybody switching from MySpace to Facebook, for example. So it's not impossible, but obviously these platforms have become so mature and so big that they also made it much more difficult. They kind of lock people in, and it's very difficult. And my friends are on there, so why should I move to this new thing? And so yeah. That is kind of the difficulty, because you are right. I mean, that's also what I said in my talk, that real alternative media understood as independent is difficult to achieve. And I gave the WikiLeaks example, but the Novara Media example is also a good one, where one day if they decide to switch you off, you lose all your content, you lose all your audience, you lose everything. And that is kind of like the power that these platforms have over alternative initiatives. So I guess it's going to have to be about a much services that have enough people thinking, yeah, let's switch because I don't want to be on these Silicon Valley platforms anymore. But that in itself also creates again dependencies and on other platforms. The gray zone, can it ever be exciting? I hope, and I'll end up, I hope with my book that I can show that it can be exciting to kind of reflect on these tensions, but also what happens in between and how these tensions sometimes collapse into each other, and that there's often a very fruitful middle, I guess, which is a good point to end on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I really want to thank Bart Hammert again for the presentation. As I said at the beginning, there's books outside and for purchase, and Bart will be signing them. Also, do stick around for the reception to catch up, ask more questions if you have more, and I'm sure there are. There are, of course, lots more exciting events at the LSE, so do check out the LSE events website, and we hope to see you here again soon, sometime in the future. Thank you very much. Luan. Sorry.
And there's a reception outside.
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.